Then there's land and land use. There, it seems like there are two different issues. Like, one, there's agricultural lands that the water could be has been or could be transferred from to development, and then there's, and then that's dry land and it can't be used for anything, is what I understand. And if I'm wrong, please let me know. But then there's also the land that's being developed and the speculation that's going on with that. Can you talk about that? Is that right? Are there two types of lands that are disappearing, those that are becoming dry lands and those that are being speculated on and just being actually developed?
There are two types. And what you have is a lot of rangeland that tends to be out of the valley floors. And that land is difficult to make a living on. You know, it's typically been ranch land and cattle grazing. And the cattle market's pretty tough market to be in. It's up and down, depend on the rain. So you have people generally from out of state come in and buy large tracts of this land and have this wonderful development planned. And they almost always include golf courses and all these things up on the Mesa land or Vega land that's up the Llano outside the valley floor. Well, that land doesn't have any water rights with it. It's never been irrigated. It doesn't have a water right. So in order to irrigate things like the golf courses or to provide water for those people, they have to transfer water out of the valley floor. Well, when you dry up a piece of agricultural land, it's gone from being productive cropland with a fairly stable amount of water consumption to, generally speaking, a weed patch. Either it's a weed patch or somebody builds houses on it and sinks more wells and double dips. Well, if it comes back up in a weed patch, then you've got a lot of riparian that comes in there, and it typically consumes more than the cultivated crop does. Alfalfa consumes a lot less water than a weed patch full of weeds and willows and salt cedar and all those things. They will consume more water than riparian does. So what does your actual wet water supply look like? Well, now you've taken twice as much water as used to be used on that land is now gone from the system, either through depletions on that land because it wasn't really vacant, and also the development on the Mesa that they've gone forward with. It's a very speculative market. I mean, in Albuquerque, the pretty famous one is the old Atrisco land grant lands, 56,000 acres on the West Mesa, no water rights, out-of-state speculators trying to get somebody to come in and provide a water supply. And they, you know, preferably an entity that has the power of condemnation so they can actually get at some water if people don't want to sell. There's a stigma attached to selling your water rights too. You know, if people find out their neighbors sold their water rights, they're not well thought of anymore. Particularly in areas like where I live, where people have been on the land for generations. They sell their water rights, they're rather viewed as traitors. And so a lot of times that water rights transfer is kind of a hidden process where you don't see it because of what we discussed earlier with the state engineer doesn't do enforcement. If you're really going to dry up farmland, you're going to have to treat that land so it's not growing anything. And how many people that live in a rural area want their neighbor's land, whether it's 5 acres or 30 acres or 100 acres, to be brown? You know, we very much value our green belt. You know, they call it that ribbon of green down the river. What happens when that's brown? But there's a bazillion houses on the mesas. Is that really what people want? Is that what they want to live? It's not where I want to live. And I really want to leave my kids some opportunities in the future to make some different decisions, because whatever we know now, it's not the same as what we'll know in the future. And by doing these kinds of transfers and not thinking about the connection between water and land use, we're leaving the future no options.
Okay. And do you see any other trends that are going on as far as water and land use in the state?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Just, you know, what's happening with the water, how things are going with the water, land?
I think right now what's happening is a free-for-all. The people that are big developers with big money really want to get at that water before everybody gets smart and figures out what all those transfers really mean. What does that mean to how my neighborhood looks? What does that mean to how my county or my valley looks? And there's a big push to make these things happen. I think that adjudication is not something that a lot of the speculators are interested in, because that's going to quantify those water rights. On the one hand, it provides security for everybody to know what how much water there is. On the other hand, you know, they want to get it for as cheap as they can get it. And there's been a lot of stuff, there's been a lot of talk about, oh, our water code is out of date and we need to do something else. And we should shift to, rather than priority in time, a priority of use. We should rank uses. And I think that's very dangerous, and that is certainly being espoused by the speculators, not by the people who have a grounding in a community. Because that priority of use, who's going to decide what the more important use is? Is it more important to grow food or to grow houses? Well, some of these speculators think it's more important to grow houses because they don't actually live here anyway, so who cares? And that's the fundamental problem. You get very different answers if you talk to someone who has a tie to a community and they're vested in that community and they have a history in that area than the people who don't live there, won't live in the subdivisions they build, don't even live in the state most of the time. But they have a lot of money to influence political decisions that fly in the face of the citizens' vision. So I see a lot of money floating around, and I'm sure it's a great temptation for a lot of people.
And you talked a little bit. Could you just kind of explain the vacancy rate that you were talking about with the?
That's a good indicator of a speculative market, is the vacancy rate. And from things I've seen in the newspaper and in news reports on television and stuff, the vacancy rate's really high. I mean, there's people in neighborhoods complaining about the vacant houses in their neighborhood drawing crime and vandalism, because it's such a, you know, the houses are owned, but by not by anyone who lives there. And we have a lot of land that's the same way, that's owned by out-of-state speculators. People all over the world own some of these subdivisions that were platted, particularly in the 60s and stuff, these antiquated subdivisions, and yet they're still on the books and they're still valid and they're still viable and they're still going to go forward if somebody wants to. But I think the housing vacancy rate's a real big problem. People tend to want something new even if it's not very well built. And I really worry what that means for the older communities. For myself, it might be really nice to see some of these older areas renovated and built up and renewed. Than, you know, we've got a lot of historic homes in this state, a lot of very old adobe homes with a lot of style, and they're just being abandoned for new construction out on the mesa where everybody's cheek by jowl and everything looks identical. And we kind of lost our identity with the big box development and the large subdivisions, because you really can't tell what state you're in. And you can in the older areas. And if you think about the places that are really attractive, that draw people in, it's the places that have preserved their history better. It'd be like Santa Fe has dreadful traffic problems and tiny little windy streets, but that doesn't matter. You know, Asheville, North Carolina is the same way. Little bitty streets, houses with all the little gingerbread trim on it. It's very quaint, very beautiful, and people love it. And they're keeping up the old parts, not just building the new parts. So I think we should value our history and value what we've had. So that vacancy rate, people building empty houses that they think are going to sell for a lot of money someday because the housing market was on a boom, you know, it's crashing. And I'm afraid that it's going to leave some ghost town areas.
Okay. And I had two more questions, and then if there's anything else you want to mention or talk about, you're welcome to. One was about, you know, food security as far as locally grown food, and I don't know if you have numbers as far as how much food is being actually that's actually staying in communities, or I don't, you know.
That's a really difficult number, because a lot of people have kind of what we used to call butter and egg money. You know, they're not doing it necessarily for their primary income, but it'll be supplementary income, and I just might not be declaring that income either, because they can't afford to a lot of times. So that's a number that's hard to get at very accurately. I mean, there's people like my father who's never responded to an agricultural census in his life, even though we have farming for a living, because he says it's just for the futures market speculators. So he just, on principle, refuses to fill those out. So you don't know how many people are doing that. But I think that we need to be very aware of these land use decisions we're making when we're transferring water off of farmland, and we're making permanent land use decisions that can never be undone, can never be changed. And we have an area in New Mexico, then the Middle Valley area can grow almost anything that can be grown in the Central Valleys of California, and did before World War II. It was almost totally self-sufficient. We've had artichokes and cucumbers and everything you can imagine grown in the Middle Valley. And California, the San Joaquin Valley is salinating very rapidly and going out of agricultural production by thousands and thousands of acres a year. And I think it's much better to maintain our food production within our borders than it is to assume that we can buy everything we want at a cheap price from out of the country. I look at it kind of like, if we don't like what happens with the price of oil these days, we're going to really hate what happens with the price of food when multinational corporations are growing the food, purchasing it, packaging, shipping, and pricing the food in this country. And the United States has gone from a food exporter to a food importer. We're very close to being a net importer year after year. Very dangerous territory, I think, for us to be importing our food, because all the countries in the world are exchanging water for food. They're importing grain rather than spending the water to grow the grain themselves, those kinds of things. The mess we had this past summer on spinach. If we had had a diversified food supply, we wouldn't have had an E. coli problem with spinach. We would have been able to grow, to get food from our local growers and trust that food supply and not have to worry about one little bit of contamination ruining the entire supply of that product by having decentralized food. But that means it's going to take cooperation from the grocery store chains to be open to something besides just their contracts with their very large produce companies, where they have a nationwide contract from one nationwide company to another, and so the small grower is cut out.
Okay. My last question is, what does it mean to be a New Mexican? And it's something that I'm having to answer for one of the grants.
What does it mean to be New Mexican? You mean personally?
Yeah, or...
Or in general? Or
in whatever way you want to answer.
Wow. I'm very proud to be a native New Mexican. I love this state, and I love the land I grew up on, where I'm raising my kids. I love the diversity of people and interests. But most of all, I love the heart the people have. I've been to other states and visited and stuff, but you don't always find that heart for the land and for an area that's diverse. I mean, it's easy to love something because it's beautiful here or it's pretty for now, and anybody can see that. But to love a land in all its changing moods and hard times and good times, that's harder to come by. And I know a lot of people with a real heart for their land and their sense of place. And I think that's largely what it means to me to be a New Mexican. And that's the way I view the other New Mexicans I know. There seems to be a big difference between the native New Mexicans and other folks, and it's that heart.
Okay. And then if there was anything else that you wanted to talk about, You're welcome too.
I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's anything. Got more than you wanted, I'm sure. No, I don't think so. I've tried to answer your questions. Okay. So.
And thank you for the interview.
You bet.